Greetings and welcome to Virtus Voices. This conference is being recorded Tuesday, February 25th, 2020. I'd now like to turn it over to Mr. Barry Mandinak, Executive Vice President and Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and thanks everybody for joining us. Today I'm joined by Doug Forman. Doug is of Kayne Anderson Rudnick. He's the CIO and has served as the portfolio manager of the Virtus Kayne Anderson Rudnick Mid-Cap Growth Fund since 2012. Doug, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
Let's dive right in the interest of time. I think the first question that I'd like to touch on is the asset class mid-caps themselves. I've heard you speak quite a bit about what you love about the asset class, and I know many people think that by allocating to large caps as well as small caps, they end up with a good mid-cap exposure. But I've heard you talk about the fact that that's not always the case. So your thoughts on the mid-cap asset class, please.
Well, to start with, it's a significant part of the U.S. equity market. It's about a quarter of the equity market, and I believe that most investors own about half of about 13-14% of mid-cap in their portfolios versus 25-26% that the area represents. And what's so attractive about mid-caps, in my opinion, is that in many cases, they're grown up, their business models are proven, their management teams have proven they can execute. I mean, we love small-cap, don't get me wrong, here at Kayne Anderson Rudnick as well, but mid-cap, there's a lot of reduced operational risk that occurs with these companies once they get into the mid-cap area. And they're at a point in their corporate life cycle where they can still grow really fast, in some cases even faster than they do when they're smaller. Because when you're starting a business, it takes time to develop a customer base, customer referrals, prove that you can do what you say you're doing, etc. By the time you get into mid-cap, you've proven all that stuff, and then and now it's just a matter of signing up more and more customers and scaling your operations. And so it's a very potentially rewarding part of a company's corporate life cycle, and contrast that, say, with large cap. And, you know, we run large cap portfolios too here, but there you got to constantly worry about saturation. You got to worry about law of large numbers. You got to worry about growth slowing down because the companies simply become too big and the numbers get astronomical to continue to have to grow at. So mid sort of the best of both worlds, I believe, and an area that most investors neglect. And what I've heard from consultants and clients and people that study the area for, I don't know, 20 plus years, is that, as you suggested in your question, is that they've got mid-cap covered by their small-cap manager and their large-cap manager. And what I say to retort to that is go take a look at our mid-cap growth portfolio and then go look at what you actually own in your portfolios and your small-cap and large-cap managers. And if there's more than 10% overlap, I'll give you $10. And what they see when they actually go and look is that theoretical overlap isn't anywhere near what they think it is. And they're missing these companies that I would argue are in the very best part of their life cycle and the very best part of stock ownership for an outside public investor.
So from your perspective, it sounds like the mid-caps are more proven than many small caps, but have a longer runway for growth than many large caps. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. In terms of the, you know, we're very familiar, most of us on the call are familiar with the Kayne Anderson DNA, if you will, what we'd expect to see in a Kayne portfolio: strong balance sheets, high cash flow, durable income, market control, and management excellence, the quality characteristics. How does this mid-cap growth Kayne Anderson portfolio fit into the Kayne DNA that people know and are familiar with from the other Kayne portfolios, and where is it different?
Well, the first part of, you know, that you mentioned about quality businesses, sustainability, the ability to protect your business from an onslaught of competition over time, all of those things are true for mid-cap growth as well. We start with that. If we don't have what we believe is a sustainable business model with a sustainable management team over a 5 or 10 year period, our turnover in mid-cap growth is very similar to our other products here in the low 20s typically. So we're going to own these stocks for 5 years or more, hopefully 10 or 15 or 20 even. So we're long-term investors across the board. Mid-cap growth is no exception. So we're trying to find businesses that are quality businesses. The difference is we add in a second step, which is, can the company meet or beat expectations over time? And the expectations that are built into these stocks are consensus Wall Street earnings expectations. And so what we try to do is find situations where the stock, and that means the stock's mispriced, because if the business is going to grow faster than what investors expect, and what investors expect is what Wall Street's telling them to expect over time, then the stock price, by definition, is mispriced. So it's this combination of a great business and a business is going to consistently exceed Wall Street expectations over long periods of time are the types of stocks that we're looking for in this portfolio. In many cases, these are disruptive or new and innovative companies that have business models that people don't quite understand yet. And so we're a little bit more willing to own in, you know, disruptors and innovative companies that are going to become Cain stocks over the long haul that everybody at Cain will agree has all those quality characteristics, even on the financial metrics that you mentioned earlier. But the difference is you won't be able to buy those companies at a small cap or even a mid-cap valuation once that actually occurs, once a business reaches maturity. Because these are businesses, in many cases, that are completely changing the dynamics of an industry. They have a very small market share and a huge market opportunity. And because of that, by the time they get to maturity, the value of the equity is going to be $40, $50, $100, $200, $300 billion. It's not going to be $2 or $3 billion when they're successful investments. So we own a few more names. Instead of 25 to 35, we own 25 to 50. Quite frankly, right now in the portfolio, we own about 50, 51 names. We've had trouble over the last year or two keeping the number of names down because we found so many attractive businesses in the mid-cap space that are businesses that are doing extremely well and likely to continue to sustain that. So it's a combination of those two things. And back to the earnings variance that we're looking for. One of the things that's important for people to understand is not that we can build a better spreadsheet and we're poring over models and getting tax rates and things right versus the competition, Wall Street. The difference is all we're doing is looking at Wall Street expectations and saying to ourselves, given what we know about the business, given what their market share is, what the market opportunity is, what their growth rates are, and what the business is doing, if Wall Street expectations aren't easily met, then we're missing something. And it's not that we have the exact number. We don't. We just want to be approximately right rather than precisely wrong. And so we want to be approximately right in the direction of the estimates over time. And I can tell you from experience of doing this for 33 years, when you have a good business that's consistently exceeding expectations and has all these quality metrics either currently or at maturity, these are the very best stocks to own in the stock market and stocks you do not want to miss in your clients' portfolios.
And in that search for these types of companies, do you have any kind of threshold levels of earnings that are required before you'll include a company in the portfolio or no?
We don't have a particular threshold, but we're not going to buy a business that, say, is not going to show earnings or some sort of free cash flow within a 3 to 5 year period. So if it's 10 years out, given their business plan and business model, we're not going to buy that. That's more venture capital than it is a public security. But as long as we have confidence that at maturity, and maturity being over a 3 to 5 year window, that the business is going to have very high returns on equity, good cash flow, good balance sheet, and has very sustainable margins. And I'll use the software business as an example. You know, I've never met a software company that had a successful product that didn't have at least 20% margins. The only issue in the software business is it's going to be 20% margins, 30% margins, 40%, or 50% or more at maturity. You know, and it depends on the type of software company and software business to be particular, and I don't have time to actually get into that. But the point is, many new software companies, some of them cloud-based today, are heavily investing in their sales force and R&D to expand the utility of their products. So they're not showing current earnings, but at maturity, we're very confident they will be extremely profitable businesses. And given the size of the market opportunities and shares that these companies have, in some cases, if you wait till maturity to buy these companies, you'll be buying them at multiple billion dollars higher than they are today. So we are okay doing that as long as we have the confidence that the margins are going to be there down the road within a reasonable time period.
Now, with many of the Cain portfolios that folks on this call probably have exposure to, characteristics that they've come to see over market cycles has been superior risk-adjusted returns, very, very strong Sharpe ratio and Sortino ratio and upside-downside capture, so smoother ride access to a bunch of asset classes that Cain has been investing in. How would you guide somebody's expectations, knowing full well that, you know, you can't guarantee what performance is going to look like, but what would you expect this portfolio to behave like relative to other Cain portfolios over the course of market cycles?
Well, what we're doing in the mid-cap growth area isn't, like I said, we have a lot more similarities to the other things that we do at Cain than we do differences, although there are a few that we've tried to point out here. But if you look at small cap, for instance, where, as you point out, it's got a smoother ride, the reason our small cap portfolios have a smoother ride is that, in general, we don't buy unprofitable businesses. We do occasionally, but not frequently. And if you look at the indexes that they're competing against, the Russell 2000 and the Russell 2000 growth benchmark, you know, you're looking at 30 5 to 40% of the index doesn't make money and never will make money in some cases. And so you've got a very low-quality benchmark, which is what we strive to avoid. I mean, we're obviously, as you know, high-quality investors across the board here. So the index is very, very poor quality. When you get to mid-cap growth, the index is a lot better. Better in the sense of the number of the percentage of unprofitable companies in the index last time I checked was in the low teens, maybe, I don't know, 12, 13%, something like that. And the quality of the businesses within the index that are unprofitable are also usually big companies that have a unique opportunity to get very large. Because if you're at a mid-cap market cap and you're unprofitable, then the market's sort of implicitly telling you that there's a very large business opportunity that they're heavily investing for in order to capture over time, and the market is still willing to afford you a mid-cap market cap. So the benchmark itself is much higher quality. And so what we're trying to do essentially is match the benchmark in terms of risk profiles over time. We're not trying to be a beta 0.6, a 0.7, or try to show great downside risk capture. If we can just perform in line in difficult markets, then we're happy with that. We've had periods where we've actually pretty dramatically outperformed in down markets, including the last few days, but that's not to be expected over time. So, you know, what you should expect with this portfolio is comparable risk characteristics, but much better returns than the benchmark can give you over time.
Well, and that leads to another question, which is very related. At this point in this industry, any active manager has to make their case relative to a financial advisor buying cheap beta exposure vis-a-vis an index. So if I'm comparing buying the mid-cap growth fund to the Russell 2000 mid-cap growth index, why would I choose the Kayne Anderson portfolio?
Well, we've simply been able to demonstrate, particularly over the last 5 years, that we've been able to add a lot of alpha relative to that benchmark at comparable risk levels overall, pretty close to the benchmark itself. And hopefully, like you said, there's no guarantees. I can't guarantee anything in this business, but I can guarantee we're going to do our best to continue to find businesses that are far superior to what investors can buy in the benchmark and generate significant alpha over time, not every day, not every year, not every month, but over any reasonable time period. If we stick with what we're doing, we think we can continue to outperform, and that's really all I can hope to do and hope and show and point you to what recent history shows.
Let's talk about the portfolio, and let's focus on the top 10 stocks, if you will. What are the characteristics of the top 10 stocks, and how do they end up getting there?
Well, they get there because of appreciation. So we're very much, as growth investors, in the camp of we water our flowers and we pull our weeds. So businesses that are not working out, and I'm not talking about the stock price the last week. I'm talking about businesses that fundamentally are not evolving the way that we thought, aren't growing the way that we thought, are experiencing headwinds in their business that we never anticipated and are going to not allow the business to grow at a reasonable rate. We are pretty ruthless about and realistic about if a growth stock's not growing, it's going to leave the portfolio. And it doesn't matter if we have a 10% loss or 20% or more loss. If we're not right fundamentally, we're going to get rid of the security. If it's just down because of, like, you know, a virus in the last week, we're not worried about that at all. That's not going to change anything structurally in the companies that we own. We're not concerned with things like that. We do get concerned if the business is not progressive the way that we thought. So on the other side of it, the good news is we water flowers. So these are businesses that are working out, that are doing exactly what we thought we were going to get when we bought the stock, or a lot better. In many cases, the ones in the top 10 are companies that ended up doing even better than we thought, and we thought that they were going to do better than what everybody else thought. And we allow them to grow until they get up to about 10% of the portfolio. We'll allow them to grow to that degree without selling and buying and trimming and adding and wasting our time doing that. I've been doing this 33 years, and I learned a long time ago, buying and adding and trimming and trying to make short-term price judgments is really a waste of time, and nobody's any good at it, including us, and I've never seen anybody any good at it in the 33 years that I've been doing this. So anything in the top 10, we never buy more than 2% at purchase of a new position in the portfolio. So as you can see, everything in our top 10 is pretty much 3% or more. So they're all businesses that have outperformed not only the market, but our portfolio. So they're businesses that have done extremely well, and we allow that flower to bloom and become a bigger piece of the portfolio until, like I said, it gets too big at 10, and then we'll cut it back. Okay. So the top 10 are all successful investments that we've made over the years, and many of these we've owned for 5, 6, 7 years, and a few new, but mainly long-term.
That's great. I always like to ask about a stock that is really illustrative of what you're trying to accomplish with this fund. And Avalara, I know, is one of those stocks that you do like to talk about. So perhaps you could share your thoughts about that stock.
Sure. You know, Avalara is a company that came public a couple of years ago. It's sort of what I would put in the category of the innovator and disruptor category. I use this one because it's an example of a company that wasn't currently profitable when it came public and we owned it. And what Avalara does is they basically provide tax information and the proper tax rate for computation at checkout at e-commerce stores. So when you buy a product online, there has to be a tax calculation associated with the state that you bought it and where you bought it. And it turns out that, like payroll, this is an extremely complicated area where there's, just in California alone, there's like 12,000 different tax rules. If you buy a Starbucks coffee and you drink it in the store, it's one tax rate. If you take it away and you take it home, it's another tax rate. And all these calculations, especially when you're online and the consumer wants to check out in a matter of milliseconds, have to be done instantly. So it's a type of business like payroll where no one company is going to do this on their own. You'd have to be out of your mind. They're going to outsource this to another business. And Avalara is a company that's assembled the critical mass and experience to actually provide these calculations online in a matter of milliseconds. It has the technology and the content people and the tax knowledge to do that. So I think it's a very protectable, competitive business. It wasn't currently profitable at the time because they were simply hiring a lot of salespeople to get more feet on the street, to get their product out there so that people could learn that they could buy it. States are now more and more interested in tax collection on internet sales as they become bigger and bigger pieces of the retail pie. The states want their money. And they're also now going to start fining people that don't pay. And so you also need to file by state. And Avalara is the one that's going to be able to do that for their customers as time goes on. So we just think it's a really well-positioned business that is very necessary and needed and has a clear early lead versus anybody else, and will benefit from huge network effects, because when you have all the customers, you can hire all the content people, you have all the lawyers, you know all the rules. It's very difficult for somebody else to try to dislodge and copy that, and they won't make much money trying to do it for a very, very, very long time. And so most people won't even attempt it. And today they're broken into free cash flow. They're close to profitability in less than 3 years from coming public. And all the spending, if they don't show profitability going forward, will only be because they've chosen to reinvest heavily in their business, which we're okay with because of the market opportunity that they have. So that's a great example of a disruptor, early stage, market cap potential, very, very large over time, a service that's needed, a clear lead, and a clear beneficiary of network effects and switching costs. Once you're in their system, you're not going to rip it out and put somebody else in. So we think it's like payroll 20 or 30 years ago, and it's really just getting started.
Okay, I'll ask one more question. To the investor who's been buying a lot of the S&P 500 for the last few years, I'd like to get your sense of how this is a diversifier to a portfolio that's much more large cap biased. Sector differentials versus the S&P 500, what kind of exposures might you have that are different that you think are worth highlighting?
Well, we do have about 40% in technology, and depending on which large cap benchmark you're looking at, the S&P 500's got 25 in traditional IT, quote, but then it's got another 10 or 11 in communication services, so it's around 36, 37. So we have a little bit more technology, not much, than the S&P 500. Tech is a great area to be invested in. It's been the single largest wealth creation industry in this country for the last, I don't know, 50, 60 years, and certainly since I've been doing this over the last 33 years. So it's an area you don't want to ignore, and we're pretty comfortable in the area and have a lot of experience investing in the area. So we've been doing that pretty successfully for a long period of time. And then, you know, consumer discretionary, we tend to have a lot of that versus the S&P 500, and it's not sort of traditional retail, but it's different types of retailers like Mercado Libre, who's sort of the Amazon of Brazil. So we have companies that are online in many cases in the consumer area. Consumer staples, we've got a little bit more than the benchmark if we compared it to the S&P 500. Financials, about the same, I think. So there's not huge differences in sector weightings, but the difference is the types of companies that we own. A lot of them are making their way into the S&P 500 over time. Like Paycom, for instance, we've owned Paycom for probably 6-7 years, and Paycom just got added to the S&P last month. And so our hope is over time these companies will make their way into these passive benchmarks over time. And our successful holdings always do, by the way. And so we're trying to, these are non-S&P 500 companies in general, by and large. And when they get to the S&P and get to the 50, 100, $200 billion are going to leave the portfolio.
Great. Just a couple of quick housekeeping items. The Virtus Kayne Anderson Mid-Cap Growth Fund, the symbol for the iShares is PICMX. The symbol for the A-Shares is PHSKX. And it is rated 5 stars overall by Morningstar, 5 stars for 3, 5 stars for 5, and 4 stars for 10 years. So it's got a terrific long-term track record there. And what I'd just like to say is that I really appreciate your time on the call, Doug. If anybody on the field didn't get an opportunity to ask a question, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Our number here is 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Or you can always visit us at virtus.com. Thanks again for your time, everyone. Thank you, Doug. Have a great remainder of your day.
You're welcome. Thank you, Barry.